Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
All right, guys, stop telling weed stories. We got to go back on the air here. Hour number two of your Ben Jarofsky show for Wednesday, December 11th. It's just moments away. But before we get into it, they're talking about smoking weed and watching Star Wars.
That's a good movie.
All right, hour number two is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, and the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. A giant thank you to those unions for jumping on board and sponsoring this program. And, of course, today's Ben Jarofsky Show is brought to you by our dear friends at the Chicago Federation of Labor. Hour number two, let's go. It is Wednesday, December 11th, and live from the Chicago Sun-Times Chicago Reader Studio on Racine Avenue, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. In this hour of the program, we still got Monroe Anderson in studio, election lawyer Adolfo Mondragon is back, and we welcome back our dear friend and host of the Doris Davenport Show. I hope she brings her dog, Doris Davenport. And now your host, Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Adolfo in the room, ready to throw a tough question at him. He's primed for his question. Before we do, they get an update from a young man?
Yeah, just a little update here. Not really much going on in the news locally. Kind of a slow news day, I guess you could say. But I'm going to throw something in at you, Ben Jarofsky. Adolfo Mondragon, Monroe Anderson. Welcome to the show, by the way, Adolfo.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right, so quick question, since the holiday's around the corner. Ben Jarofsky, and since you don't have to
sound so nervous about the question.
No, don't be nervous.
It's
an easy question. Okay. Let's figure out, I just decided to do this like 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. What is the best Christmas movie?
Oh boy. What's that movie? With the kid. He gets the BB gun.
Christmas Story.
Oh, man. Come on.
Oh, Christmas Story.
Home Alone, man. I got to just tell you this, Adolfo.
You said the kid, so I was like,
let me give my choice first.
Yeah.
Die Hard.
Die Hard's good, man. Yeah. Die Hard's good.
Die Hard.
That's been a debate. That's
a big debate, yeah. Whether it's a Christmas movie or not.
And it's a Christmas song. It's a Christmas theme. Yep. It's just not one of those
Die Hard 2 is set in Christmas, too.
Yeah, you know?
Die Hard.
It's a Christmas movie.
It's awesome.
No, yeah. I saw our Thanksgiving time they were playing Home Alone 3. I think it was Home Alone 3. Wow. It could have been Home Alone 2.
Was Macaulay Culkin in it?
Yeah, he was.
Okay, so it's not 3.
Oh, it's 2.
Was it with Michael Jackson?
Is it the one with Trump? Trump comes in the plaza?
Yes!
Yeah.
Okay, that is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I've never seen it before. I saw I only saw about a half hour, but God, is that a bad movie? Yeah. It is.
Actually, it's the better of the two, I think, in my opinion, but anyway.
Did John Hughes direct it? You don't know.
I don't know.
All right. So
we're asking all of you as well on the YouTube live stream chat. Let's figure this out before Christmas.
So
time.
He says, what did you say, Monroe?
Die Hard.
And I said Christmas Story. And what do you say, Adolfo?
I have to think about it. There's so many. You know, that I hadn't thought in a while, but it's been playing on cable. Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Oh, I love
it. Oh, man.
Chevy Chase.
It's a bit nipply outside. Nippy.
There's lots of good ones. Like, it's a Wonderful Life. It's really good.
Yeah, I've seen that a million times.
Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, White Christmas.
Love Always.
Yeah, Love Always. I'm not a big fan of Love Always, but I
liked it. Yeah,
Christmas Story. I love that one.
Die Hard is the best.
But it's hard to argue against Die Hard. I really did enjoy it. I just don't think of it as a Christmas movie.
Remember when they're in the car and he starts playing this song, this rap song.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he says, could you put on some Christmas music? And he says, this is Christmas music. Yeah.
So what the hell? Why not? What is the best Christmas movie? We'll see if we can get a poll going here. We'll post it on the Facebook page as well. If you're listening on the live stream chat, weigh in. Maybe we can get some more talk about that as well. You know, it's the holiday season. Let's have a little fun here. What's the greatest Christmas movie? No one asked me. Thanks a lot. But I'm going to say mine is Friday After Next.
I, again, don't think of that as a Christmas movie, but whatever. I guess I have to say, if we choose your selection as the Christmas movie, best Christmas movie of all time, Dennis will send you steak knives.
There you go.
Steak knives will be in the mix. Remember the steak knives promotions?
Oh, Frank's weighed in. He said his is Muppet Christmas Carol.
Well, that is a legitimate Christmas movie. I don't know if I'd make it my top five. All right, Adolfo, here's the hard question for you. Don't duck and dodge, all right? All right. The Democrats voted two counts of articles of impeachment yesterday against Donald John Trump. Mm-hmm. I applaud them for doing so. I believe that Donald John Trump deserves to be impeached. His obstruction of justice, which I don't even know if it's actually one of the two articles of impeachment. The obstruction of justice is as egregious as anything Nixon did back in 1973 with Watergate, with his open defiance of Congress and its subpoenas. So I do believe he deserves to be impeached. But my question to you is this. Did the Democrats wimp out in the 2003 and 4 when they didn't impeach George W. Bush for openly lying about the reasons we were supposed to go to war in Iraq?
No, I don't think so. And I guess on the spot, this is what I've come up with. Impeachment is like last resort, emergency button kind of things that have to elevate to a very disastrous kind of situation, such as the one that we're experiencing now. Lying about the war, although, you know, it's a horrible thing. In fact, Cheney lied even after he left office. He kept saying that there were weapons of mass destruction, and even though that was debunked years before. That was a horrible thing to use to take us to war. I think it's the First Amendment provides for freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of expression. And therefore, I think it's society's a role there, the press, organizations, etc., to counter lies like Trump, when Trump lies about clearly truthful things, you know, things that are not what he says they are. And about the war, I think the press, and they debunked the whole, there was weapons of mass destruction. I think it's their role to counter a lie like that. Now, if a lie is of such nature that it is a high crimes and misdemeanor, or it's a bribery associated lie or whatever, then of course it should be cause for impeachment. But that lie alone, the lie about, well, there was weapons of mass destruction, I don't think is the kind that gets resolved through an impeachment. I think is the kind that gets countered through the First Amendment and the fact that we have newspapers and journalists, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm. Wow. Should there be any kind of impeachment? Do you believe that the Democrats were justified in voting for those two articles of impeachment?
Absolutely. I think that's at the heart of what impeachment is all about. And as benign or mundane as it may seem to Republican folk, which is BS because they don't believe that, that is just because what they're impeaching him for, you know, extorting basically or taking bribery from Ukraine, although they didn't word it as bribery, they worded it as abuse of power, didn't explode in a manner that, like, you know, the normal person would think, like, wow, well, that was really egregious. What he did is at the heart of what impeachment is about.
Right.
And so whether it seems to you small or large, or you know, something that you is tangible to you as a normal citizen, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. What matters is that if we allow this to happen and it sets precedents, it sets horrible precedents that start eroding our system of government.
And the founding fathers put impeachment in the Constitution for Donald Trump or somebody Absolutely. Like him. Right. I mean, it was put in there. They because they debated it back in 1787. Mm-hmm. They had this whole debate about whether it should do it. And they said, well, one guy argued, and I forget the characters, but one argued that, well, if we have a bad president, we can get rid of him in an election. And they said, well, if he's a bad president and he's fooling the people, then he won't be gotten rid of. That's why we need a way of getting rid of him if he's out of control. You know, and with this, one of the Republican arguments right now is we're having an election in 11 months. Mm-hmm. So why impeach him? Well, we can do it. The American people can decide on it. Well, we know that Trump is cheating, has cheated, and will cheat to win the election. Yeah. So why would you keep him around so he could cheat and win again?
Right. And part of to debunk that Republican, you know, well, we have an election coming up, is impeachment doesn't say, like, well, you can only do it in year three or year four, year two, year one. You play a slippery slope argument when you say, well, you could only impeach during the first 2 years. Well, then you say, well, what if the crime is nascent and it hasn't come up till year three or year four? Mm-hmm. You know, so there is no timeline, first of all, in the wording of it. And even practically, you can't impose a timeline because it leads to absurd results in terms of, like, well, where do you put the dividing line in terms of pre this you can't impeach or post that you can't impeach? It's stupid. Impeachment by nature is the, you know, the red button. You know, it's only you break the case only when, you know, you something like this happens and you have to, because it doesn't matter about elections. You know, it's in and of itself, it's something that is so so dangerous to our system of government that we can't wait for an election.
Well, I would argue, I see, again, I'm for the impeachment investigation. And in general, I welcome any kind of investigation. I like transparency. And I like when you have these types of investigations, truths come out that are concealed. And then you could decide what the truth is. You know what I'm saying? As whether you believe Donald John Trump or whether you believe like the ambassador to the European Union. You know what I'm saying? On a very important piece of a very important issue. But when I think about it, Adolfo, and I go back and look at my lifetime since I started paying attention, I think a very compelling case could be made to impeach Lyndon Baines Johnson. Monroe just pointed out, lied about the Gulf of Tonkin, the whole justification for the war in Vietnam, which killed thousands
and scared the living daylights out of me when I was in college.
Did not want to get drafted. Exactly. Okay, let's just put that impeachment article number one, scared Monroe into smoking reefer. You could argue that Richard Nixon, there were impeachment articles drawn up against him, and that ignores his lying with the Vietnam War. And then you go into George W. Bush and his lying. I could even argue that.
Well, was it just a matter of you're saying that simply because they lied or because they actively covered it up?
I'm saying twofold. It's a great question, challenging me to force me to say what exactly I'm saying. I appreciate that. Twofold. One, in order to gin up support for a war that was unnecessary, they lied.
Okay.
And there were huge consequences paid by other people for their lies.
Right.
And sacrifice of ideals. Every president has, from Johnson to Nixon to Bush, has told us there's a compelling reason why people should give up their lives, the greatest sacrifice they can make. There's a compelling national interest at stake. And then it turns out that there are no national interests at stake.
See, so for me, if they actively covered it up so that the press and other people in society couldn't dig up the alternative argument to their lie, then I think that might rise to something impeachable.
You're saying it's not an impeachable offense to lie.
Just to lie. No, I mean, Trump lies every other second, right? And you're not going to hold him, impeach him to every single lie that he has. But like here, where they actively did things to obstruct, where they actively did things to conceal, that in and of itself, that nefarious activity right. is what is impeachable.
And we have national security at risk as a result of what Trump did in the Ukraine.
Well, I would say national security was at risk in each one of these instances where LBJ lied about that got us involved with the Vietnam War. Total national security is at risk.
Well, we were dropping napalm on brown people. That was okay.
I think that's an impeachable offense right there. I know you're being sarcastic when you say that, but I'm struggling with this. You know, and then the alternative is to say nothing's impeachable. And that we just leave it up to the elections. But Monroe's point has always been that everything Donald Trump has been doing since he announced his campaign back in 2015 has been intended to win re-election. And if that means cutting deals
with... This is the other problem. It's Trump is a white supremacist, a white nationalist. He said he was a nationalist. He left the white off, but he said he was a nationalist. And his agenda has been to keep America white. If you look at his policies, particularly the immigration policies. And so from my perspective, that's impeachable itself.
Well, no, that's just, I mean, he has a right to believe what he believes, right?
And yeah, but to act on it where you separate... thousands of children from their mothers.
Right, and that's for the courts, then that's the fight.
Wait, time out. So do you think that's an impeachable offense?
Yes.
Separating families at the border is an impeachable offense?
I think the entire white supremacist agenda, dividing Americans, I think that's an impeachable
offense. Ginning up a war where whole families are blown up in Iraq is not an impeachable offense.
Well, the problem with that is the military industrial complex.
We were talking about this earlier today.
Has to be fed. See, you know, there's one theory on. I mean, one of the defenses for the gun industry is they keep us armed, so we can protect ourselves from the rest of the world. I mean, that's been an argument.
There's actual merit to some of that argument because historically, you know, countries that produced the ones that won the wars were the ones that produced the better guns, et cetera, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, the thing about lies, it's not that the lie in and of itself is always impeachable. It may be in certain circumstances. But to me, I think most of the time, if you're going to get someone impeached on lies or a lie, it's because of whatever... the nefarious activities to cover up that lie, you know, because of that, not because of the lie itself. If someone sheds light on the lie, some people will still believe the lie.
Yeah.
Like they did with the Bush lie about there was weapons of mass destruction. They repeated that lie so often. If you ask Cheney today, he'll still tell you that there was weapons of mass destruction.
I don't know. You know, if it serves his interest at that moment, that's creative lying, if you right. will. If it serves,
but there's that
tactical lying,
there's
strategic
that
lying.
There's that doctrine that if you repeat a lie enough, people will believe it, right? It. So
even if you then change the story a little bit, Now this gets to a theme that I've been raising today. I talked about this before you came in there, on the air, Adolfo. I've already talked about this with Monroe. The success with which Donald Trump has taken over the Republican Party is mind-boggling.
It is.
Because if you talk about... I'm like raising these issues of principle that people of good intention can come together and take a look at the evidence and reach a conclusion. Reasonable people can reach a conclusion. What we've set up is a situation where the Republican Party is essentially saying we cannot believe any of the reports that our FBI say on matters dealing with Donald
Trump.
They've
just basically did a 180 on everything that they've ever believed for just so that they could protect this president. I think also an interesting dynamic is look at the way the Democratic Party treats Bernie and how they haven't kowtow to him, but the Republicans have kowtowed to. And my point is this, that generally institutions like a Democratic Party or a Republican Party that go back hundreds of years have a hierarchy, have a culture where, you know, the people in the top, the elite, are the ones who set the rules. It's, you know, top to bottom, not bottom to top, usually, although there might be some different dynamics. My point is that when Trump ran, the entire elite of the Republican office was against him. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it mind-boggling, that the fact that somehow, as soon as he got into office, that elite no longer was able to hold the party. They lost the party to Trump so easily. When this is an elite that's been instituted for hundreds of years, people like that who have money and influence don't generally lose a party overnight. And just the way the Democrats are not losing their party overnight. They're fighting tooth and nail to have Bernie, you know, restructure and re-agenda their party. That's why
they're fighting against Bernie.
Yeah. That's what you would have expected in the Republican Party. People to have rigged the race against Trump, just the way the Democrats rigged the race against Bernie last time. And all the things that they're still doing to not bring in Bernie to the fold, you would expect the Republican institution, the elites of the Republican Party, to be doing the same things. That's why it boggles the mind.
Since Reagan, the Republican Party has been morphing into this white nationalist party. And so Trump was the leader they were waiting for.
The fact that the Tea Party and all these little things started accumulating over the years, and they waited for their moment, and then they. But right. Still, you would still think that there would be a battle between the elites, like the Bushes, etc., up on the top, with the Tea Partiers over who gets to rule, Trump or the party,
mm-hmm.
Right?
All
right?
Yeah, well, there was a battle, and they lost.
Well, but it was like quick, so you would think it would have been something that.
All right. You got that? I would love to hear Monroe and Adolfo riff on this. I wrote about this this week in the Reader. This has been on my mind. Probably asked some of our other guests who come on this question too, so they should be prepared for it. And this has to do with the ongoing division in the Democratic Party. My beloved Democratic Party, been a regular Democratic Democrat voter since the 1970s, and I look at this split in the Democratic Party and the inability of the mainstream of the Democratic Party to give Bernie Sanders the respect that he deserves and he warrants, in my humble opinion. This reminds me of what went down in the 80s with Jesse Lewis Jackson when he ran a very Bernie Sanders-like a movement. If you take a look at what Jesse Jackson was running on in 1988 and 1984, Monroe Anderson, and you're probably the only guy in the studio old enough to remember.
I remember the speech he gave at the convention.
In 84,
I was 10. I was 10 years old. The one where about the ghetto. You can take the kid out of the ghetto or something.
You're probably mixing up a different Jesse Jackson speech.
Yeah, right. Speech. No, I went to New Hampshire with Jesse.
In 88 or 84?
In 84. In his fact-finding mission. He wasn't even a candidate at that time.
He was drumming up support. There. Yeah. But there's been a lack of respect for the left and the Democratic Party by the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And this was exhibited in Hillary Clinton's comments to Howard Stern regarding Bernie Sanders. You got it? Let's play it, D.
Worry a lot.
Because you know what the shenanigans are.
Yes, I worry a lot.
You've negotiated with them. You've seen secret intelligence.
I have.
And you know that, there's these guys who phone from Nigeria who phone your home and somehow finagle $6,000 out of you by doing that. Yeah. And you're brilliant at it.
Yeah, yeah.
I can only imagine what's going on when Vladimir Putin sits there and plans against the United States.
Well, but you can read the indictments against the Russians. And a lot of people didn't pay attention to it, but it's very informative and scary.
Do you mean the Mueller report?
Yeah, the indictments.
Okay.
The report itself, I think, is also worth reading. But if you read the indictments, basically they were like, hey, let's do everything we can to elect Donald Trump. I mean, those are quotes.
Those are
taken,
words they
those
said.
Those are words that taken, and they also said Bernie Sanders, but, that's another for another day.
Do we hate Bernie Sanders?
What?
Do we hate Bernie Sanders?
No, I don't hate anybody.
Bernie could have endorsed you quicker.
He hurt me. There's no doubt about it. He hurt me. But going back to the indictments, because that's right. What's really important.
Have you ever spoken to Bernie about that?
No. No.
You don't talk to him?
I don't talk to him. I mean, we did when he finally endorsed me and all that.
But you're upset with him?
No, disappointed. Disappointed. Okay. So, and I hope he doesn't do it again to whoever gets the nomination.
All right, man. I mean, dude, I listen to that
condescension in there, man.
This kind of she's not gonna. I hope he doesn't do it to get everyone his nomination, as you know, as opposed to Bernie winning the nomination. There's there's always that. He's like number one or two in a lot of the polls. The notion that Bernie Sanders didn't endorse her fast enough, Monroe Anderson, I remember it took Hillary Clinton a little while. I was telling Doris Davenport this the other day. It took it took Hillary Clinton a little while before she forgave Barack Obama and got around to endorsing him. And the studies have shown that more Hillary Clinton supporters in 2008 voted for John McCain as opposed to Barack Obama, then Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016 voted for Trump over Hillary Clinton. So this notion that somehow or other Bernie Sanders has been unfaithful or untrue to Hillary Clinton's political ambitions is unfounded. And I think it does shows tremendous disrespect for the lefties of the Democratic Party who support Bernie Sanders because they believe in his political programs. What do you think, Monroe Anderson?
I think that I'm surrounded by Bernie Bros. And I think that the problem is Bernie was not a Democrat. Hillary was. And so she.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
It has. If you are a Chicago Bear and not a Detroit Lion.
All that means is that you're not the guy someone's, you know, you're not somebody somebody sent.
No. You know? What it means is that you have built up all these chits. Politics is favors and chits and what have you.
So it goes back to the heart of it. It's entitlement. It's the elite of the party's entitlement.
No.
And they're fighting for their lives.
No, it's the elite, and it's also the association. I'm a member of the National Association of Black Journalists. If somebody who used to be a computer nerd comes into the NABJ, is not part of the group, then you're not going to get the same allegiance as if you've been around everybody.
No, I think the analogy would be more like if someone who was an independent journalist, a Pulitzer Prize winning, who covered black issues that affected the black community, tried to go into your organization. That's more what the Sanders thing is.
I
got to
tell you this. Let me just say this. Okay. I'm listening. I've heard this argument that Bernie's not a quote-unquote real Democrat because he calls himself a Democratic Socialist. He runs as
an independent. Right.
Okay. I don't know what that has to do with the fact that Bernie was out on the campaign trail throughout October telling people in Iowa they should vote for Hillary Clinton.
If he's
over
such an
Donald
independent,
John
why
Trump.
Does she want his help?
But I will say this. I alluded to the presidential campaign of one Jesse Lewis Jackson in 1984, 1988. And let me just put on the record, I voted for Jesse Lewis Jackson in 1988 and 1984. I voted for Harold Washington's coalition. People forget that Harold Washington ran a contingent of delegates in 84. But I'll say this, Jesse Lewis Jackson was no Democrat either. If you go back and look, Jesse Lewis Jackson always preached independence from the Democratic machine, and Jesse Jackson
so he was talking locally. Not national. He was talking locally.
You guys, you changed in the...
No. Okay, Ben. No. This is the reality. Somebody who's been involved in this intimately to some extent. Chicago Democrats are not Democrats. They're Republicans in sheep clothing. Or I don't know what they are. I mean, they're a special breed, but they are not as hooked into the Democratic Party.
The
as
point
some other
is
places.
That I heard the argument used against Jesse Jackson in the 80s that he's not a good Democrat, that he is not, he's broken from the party at certain key times. You can't depend on him to support the ticket. So as a good Democrat, I'm not going to vote for him. I'm going to vote for Gary Hart, let's say, or Richard Gavin Hart.
That's the racial thing again. See, that's where it gets tricky. If you recall, as I do, when Bernie Upton, when Harold became the nominee for mayor, mm-hmm. then all these Democrats became Republicans literally overnight.
What Bernie isn't a Democrat or people aren't a Democrat really means is it's not that this person doesn't espouse all of the principles of the Democratic Party, which is what it really should matter, what really should matter between a Democrat and a non-Democrat. It's you didn't wait your turn.
No, you didn't
go through the system. The elites up here expect that you have paid your dues through the different machines and through all the different machineries or whatever. But if Bernie did that, he would never be in a position where he's at now.
He
espouses the same things that the Democratic Party does.
That's not it. But parties are relationships. That's power.
You're just talking about relationships,
which turn into power. But it's a common experience.
He threw a monkey wrench to their power system, and he usurped the power system and went right from the bottom to the top.
He didn't usurp anything. Hillary was the nominee, so he didn't usurp anything.
Wow. When he's the nominee this time, he'll be usurping.
No, he's not going to win this time either.
But I will say this. What she said that rubbed me the wrong way, as I told Doris Davenport, is that Bernie went on the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton, and Bernie put out an effort to get Hillary Clinton elected. And whatever differences they had in the aftermath of a very contentious election, after a reasonable amount of time, which was not much more time than Hillary took before she officially forgave Barack Obama, Bernie endorsed her. He gave a passionate speech at the convention on her behalf. And then he went out and he's campaigned for her. And there's no appreciation shown for her, for him, for his efforts. It's ingratitude.
Because it's irrational. The people who hate Bernie hate it for one of several reasons. One, either these members of the elite that are fighting for the life of their party and what they're entitled to. Or two, it's because they're these bleeding heart liberals who think they're enlightened because they have degrees from Harvard and they make great amount of money and they vote Democratic the whole time. But what it really exposes is the fact that they don't give a shit about black people. They don't give a shit about brown people. They just like the fact that they have their rights to an abortion and that they, you know, that they could keep making money.
I would like to point out, before we go any further, that the man who said that, Adolfo Mondragon, is himself a graduate of Yale University.
That's right, but I don't come from the elite. But I don't come from the elite. I'm not an old guru. He knows how they are. And that's why I know, because I've been in there.
I just had to throw that out there when you said the Harvard thing.
That's how I know the enemy. And by the way,
I just forgot for a moment. What law school did you go to?
The University of Chicago.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions?
The Devil's Den. Yes, I know that. But that's why I know the enemy so well.
Some valid points there. But
I'm not a Bernie hater. But there exists.
I know there are some people who said before he ran for president were like, oh, Bernie's the greatest, you know, because he's a feminist and this and that. All of a sudden he's anti-woman, anti-this.
All right. Now, before we close down this discussion, which could go for another hour, I'm sure, we'll have to bring you two back for this one and bring on Doris Davenport and her mystery guest, I might add. You raised the issue of hate.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll close with this question for each of you. In addition to the comments about Bernie in the Howard Stern interview, Hillary said she doesn't hate anybody.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that comment. Yeah. But it's bullshit, you know that, right? Okay, wait. Let me get to my question. So I will ask you, but I had this conversation with Ramana Hussein on Friday about the whole notion of hating, whether you hate somebody in politics or you just dislike their political views, et cetera, and so forth. So we'll close with this. Monroe Anderson, I'll start with you. Do you think that Hillary Clinton hates Bernie? And then the second one, is there anybody in politics today that you hate?
I think she probably strongly dislikes Bernie. I'm not sure, but I don't know. I don't know. I don't know her that well. As for me, I'm not a hater. I'm a lover. Except
you and Michael.
except for one Donald J. Trump. Because I hate racists. I mean, that's the only thing I hate is racists. And the man is a bold-faced racist.
I cannot argue with you on that point at all. Adolfo, same question
I
to
think,
you.
Yeah, I think Hillary hates Bernie. The hate is real. I've seen it. And among people that I know, the hate is real. And it's irrational, it's stupid, but the hate is real. And it's hypocritical. And two, yeah, I hate Trump. I hate Miller. I hate a bunch of these racists, you know. Why am I going to say, oh, I'm going to, you know, semantically say I have a lot of contempt, but I don't hate Trump. I pray for him like Pelosi did.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Bullshit.
Exactly.
Come
on. Yeah, because since I'm not a Christian, then I don't have to go. You know, I mean, you know, like with the with Roof, who killed those people in the black church just because they were, you know. Because they were as they prayed with him, and then the family comes in later and says, "Well, I forgive him, you know, because God is something like that." I don't have that capability. I just I don't have that capacity.
Well, I'm a Catholic, and I still hate Trump. So.
Well, I struggle with the whole hate thing. I told Doris Davenport this. I really don't like saying I hate somebody, but it's just. I struggle with that one, but there's a lot of people, as Adolfo and Monroe are saying, yeah, man, they really rubbed me the wrong way. And we'll leave it at that. It's always a blast talking politics with Monroe Anderson and Adolfo Mondragon. We got Doris Davenport and a mystery guest on deck. We're going to ask this mystery guest a lot of these same questions. Uh-oh, mystery guest is breaking out in a sweat. I know we can handle it. We'll be right back after this.
The Ben Jarofsky Show is supported by Northwestern University's part-time master's program in literature and liberal studies. Students learn from dynamic and diverse faculty as they build advanced skills for critical analysis, writing, and research. Evening classes are held on Northwestern's Evanston and Chicago campuses. The spring quarter application deadline is January 15th. Learn more at sps.northwestern.edu/masters. Read the Chicago Reader to get up to speed on what's what in Chicago. Culture, food, arts and entertainment, weekly concert listings, weekly event listings, the environment, travel. I can continue, but you get the point. And for all of you Chicago political junkies, raw weekly columns on real city politics from Maya Dukmasova and our very own Ben Jarofsky. The Chicago Reader, free to the public in newsstands throughout the city and online at chicagoreader.com. Read it now and be a more informed Chicagoan.
Hey, commercial break's over, everybody. Welcome back to the Ben Jarofsky Show, live from the Chicago Sun-Times.
We are indeed live, and boy, that was a lively little debate going, Monroe Anderson and Adolfo Mondragon. Reminds me, Dr. D, of the days back when we could just... The callers would call in on Bernie and Hillary, and those debates, you just mention it, and all of a sudden people would be calling in. There's a division in the Democratic Party. That is very real. It's one the Democrats are going to have to deal with, my humble opinion.
The days before you got fired.
Yes, the days before. You had to say that. I was taking the high road on it. And those divisions are still there, the Hillary-Bernie divisions. I'm a guy who voted for both of them. How about that? Huh? I voted for Bernie in the primary, turned right around and voted for Hillary in the general. Anyway, Doris Davenport is with us, one of my favorite people in the whole world. She has a mystery guest that we'll be introducing as well. But do you have an update for us before we turn things over to Doris?
Once again, find us on social media at Benny J Show, BENNY, the letter J Show, on Facebook and Twitter. Let me go over to the Ben Jarofsky Show live stream YouTube chat. Kathy, by the way, she's always been wanting to follow us on YouTube. She found us on YouTube. She put dead air. Yeah, it's not radio anymore. Sometimes we'll just not play things on the air. So, yeah. Let's chill out. We'll be fine. And we'll come back.
It's called a podcast. Yeah,
yeah. A little different things than radio. Let's see here. Let's see. Kathy says, we need better choices. We need better candidates. The parties are the ruling class and have no interest in the people. What do you think about what Kathy said there, Ben?
I don't know if I'll go that far, but I do think that the Democratic Party should not be so belligerent toward people of the leftist persuasion. I believe that, and I saw it very much the case in the 1980s when Jesse Jackson ran, as I said, and that was fueled, and also that it got to the complications of racial issues. The Democrats were really, they didn't want to alienate black voters who voted for Jesse Jackson, but they didn't want to really embrace the ideas that Jesse Jackson was raising. And he was way ahead of his time with that campaign of his in the 1980s. So I wouldn't say that the parties are the root of all evil. I've been voting Democrat my entire life. But I would say I believe that the Democrats should be a little more tolerant of the lefty views of their base. So that's how I
And finally, Doug weighed in on the live stream chat. Thank you very much, Doug. Doug says, Bernie 2020.
Okay. Bernie lover. Doris Davenport, your thoughts on the Bernie. I gave you that article to read. Now you're absorbed with that article. I knew you would be all over. Wait, give it back to me just for a second. What do they call it?
Emotional support.
Oh, boy, that's all I needed. Emotional support. Doris Davenport's a regular on the show. She's a radio show host at the station, WCPT. Hey, I said it. How about that, Doris?
I saw you even took a picture in front of the WCPT banner.
Did I?
Yes, he did. I saw
did
it.
Did he?
No, not recently.
What did you see
Dennis's
face?
I don't remember that. But
you know, okay, maybe it was an old picture.
It was an old picture.
He's over it, but yeah. He's not that over
I'm
it.
I'm not that over it.
Yes, you are. You're coming on my show.
Well, Doris Davenport, I would do that. I don't know. I would maybe do a phone interview. But you've always had the thing I was going to raise. What is it called? Emotional?
Oh, well, wait. Okay, we're going to get back to Bernie.
Yeah, let's go back to Bernie before. Really wanted to get your opinions about what we were talking about. I knew you were listening here. Mm-hmm. You could not hear what Hillary Clinton said to Howard Stern about Bernie Sanders because that was played over the mic, over the headphones. But she said essentially she is still a little upset. And disappointed is the word she used with Bernie for not supporting her more quickly. Mm-hmm. I like to point out that it took her quite a while before she decided
to
endorse.
Me.
Yes, because fair is fair, okay? If you get like a month off before you endorse Barack Obama, you should give Bernie the same month off before. I mean, because listen, our mystery guest was involved in a very contentious re-election battle. Okay, we'll get into that. And I'm sure he wasn't singing Kumbaya to the guy he ran against a week after.
At least not within the first 24 hours.
Yeah, it takes a while to get over a very divisive election. And so for the Hillary supporters to say Bernie took too long, I feel is unfair to Bernie, considering that Hillary took her own sweet time to forgive Barack Obama for the high crime of running against her in 2008. So that's my thoughts on that. Now you tell me your thoughts.
Well, I mean, first of all, that's correct. I agree with everything you just said. But you have to remember, I mean, only people like us who are in the bubble remember that, right? That she took all that time before she endorsed Obama. The point of Hillary saying it now is banking on nobody remembers that. And just positing, we got to save the party. That's what this is about. This is about Bernie not winning, getting all of the voters that may have issues with the Democrats for all the reasons that the dear senator mentioned. Because, yes, my dear Democratic Party has a history of not taking care of home base while they're taking care of everybody else. Black people in the community, number one. I can speak because it's my family, right? We can talk about each other. But I think that's what she's doing. Those Democrats that could be on the bubble or, you know, looking at the Warren, too, for that matter. She's making a case as to why they shouldn't look Bernie's way. But I'm going to tell you something else. I think there is this love-hate relationship between Clinton supporters and Bernie supporters, without a doubt. Now, I disagree with the senator because I know I'm going to get flack for this, but I experienced it. So this is firsthand knowledge. Bernie supporters, when I supported Hillary, they were so mean. Oh, my God. I thought they were going to come after me with, like, bottles and stuff, really. And so I do think that there's no way you're going to find Hillary Clinton standing there singing Kumbaya for Bernie Sanders. But do you remember, and I listened to part of the interview, do you remember when she was talking about her father and she spent a lot of time talking about her father because Howard kept asking her all these questions? Well, she used the word gruff. And then she talked about how her father used to knock her brothers around. So there was a bit of domestic violence there. And he was a yeller. I think Bernie reminds her of her father. And that's why she doesn't like him. I really do.
That's deep.
He's very loud. He's very boisterous. He's very, you know, like he just pushes.
Wow.
Not that he pushes people around, but he looks like he could. I think he reminds her of her father.
Could be. I know it's funny you should say this since it's true confession time on the Ben Jarofsky show, that when Bernie first burst on the scene and he was always bellowing and stuff, he reminded me a lot of people I know in my own family that would be yelling and screaming at Thanksgiving time. And so I had my issues. I had to deal with that as well. So I understand that I was able to put it aside because I liked the things he was yelling. But I hear what you're saying, Doris Davenport. There is a certain style that people have. And it's funny because a style a campaigner has, it could appeal. This is going to be so obvious, but it's true. I just loved Harold Washington.
Yeah. Who didn't?
Well, a lot of people didn't. He barely got elected in 1983 when he ran. And the thing that I loved about him, his style, a lot of people disliked it. You know, he's too combative. He's too assertive. He's
too charismatic.
Too charismatic. And the same thing with Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson, I've always appreciated Jesse Jackson's rhetorical capabilities, you know, his oratorical supremacy. The man is...
He's got the gift of gab.
Gifted, to put it mild. A lot of people, I can't stand him with Jesse Jackson. So I guess, you know, that, by the way, here's...
Oh, that's so great.
So anyway, I do want to bring our mystery guest on and spend a good chunk of our time chatting with our mystery guest. But before we do that, I must address this story. This had your name written all over it. And as long as people know this, Doris, there was a story about her in the Chicago Tribune. She testified in a case regarding the ability of people to pass petitions in Millennium Park. I'm with you 100% on that one.
We're waiting for the ruling as we speak any day now.
All right. Well, we've talked about this in the show. Pat Quinn's been on the show talking about it. You've been on the show talking about it. The police will not let people pass petitions in Millennium Park. For some reason, Millennium Park is sacred ground. You can't pass a petition, even though it's a publicly funded park.
But Rahm Emanuel can go and give a political speech there. Just saying.
That is correct. You're pointing out an inconsistency, just as I pointed out one with one Hillary Rodham Clinton. but this gets back to this is issue of dogs, using dogs. What is it?
Emotional support dogs.
Emotional support dogs. And there was a big article in today's Tribunal, which I brought here because I knew Doris was coming, about the whole issue of there are too many emotional support dogs on airplanes.
Yeah.
And you usually have your dog with you. In the Tribune story, they talked about how when you testified in that case, you had the dog with you.
That's right.
It's a great scene in the Tribune story. Whoever the reporter is, I give him or her credit. So what's your stance on this? Too many dogs on airplanes?
Well, so here's the deal. There is a problem, and I'm very fearful that they're going to go the wrong way and hurt people that shouldn't be hurt. There is a lot of abuse in the emotional support dog world. And that's because if you go online and you want to get a license or a vest or something for your dog, everybody's giving them away for, you know, as much as you'll pay. You can get from $50 to $150 a fake letter from a doctor that says you have the right to have an emotional support dog. Clearly, you know, the book that comes out on psychological disorders, there's a very specific list of disorders that people who have emotional support dogs can get a letter from their doctor saying this person needs an emotional support dog. People just want to take their dogs with them. That's the problem. They put a bow on the hair. They don't train them. They've never spent a day in canine discipline school. And they bring the dogs wherever emotional support dogs are supposed to be able to go. Mm-hmm. Now, you know Mr. Precious Love. Everybody knows Mr. Precious Love. He's been trained since the day he came out. Mm-hmm. He's been with me since he was 7.5 weeks old. When I say stop, he stops. When I say sit, he sits. But we have a strong communication. He's not just a pet.
And he was trained that way.
So if Mr.
Precious Love sees another dog, he's not going to bolt to the other dog, start barking.
No. No, he's not. Now, he's a dog, so he might, you know, have a little low growl going on. Mm-hmm. But he's not like, I mean, there are children more undisciplined than Mr. Precious Love. They won't stop crying when you say, I mean, frankly, I don't want to go there, but that is my feeling. If we ban emotional support dogs, then maybe we should ban babies from the planes.
Wow.
I mean, they're a bit of a problem for people.
The views and opinions expressed by Doris Davenport are not necessarily those of the Ben Jarofsky Show. I am not for banning babies, okay? I just want to get that
out. Well, I'm not either. I'm just kind of...
I know, you're making a point.
Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah, but there is a lot of abuse in that program. But I absolutely do not support only having... service dogs, as they're called, for vets. I think that is an isolation of psychological disorders and physical disabilities. And I think it would be an issue of discrimination. And I would be on a lawsuit if they ban emotional support dogs. I absolutely would.
All right, well, this is an issue that's coming. We'll probably spend more time talking about this down the road. I'm a big, I love dogs dearly. And when I read this article, I thought of you. And then there was other animals that, like, somebody wanted to bring a peacock on an airplane.
A snake.
A snake. There's a movie called Snakes on a Plane, one of Dennis's favorite movies. So we'll hold this off for another time. So allow me to ask you to introduce your mystery guest. Who
yes.
is your mystery guest?
So I'm really, really excited about this because, you know, this is election time. There are a lot of races that we're going to have to vote on. And there's a really, really popular race. And that is the race for the clerk of the circuit court. The seat was held by Dorothy Brown. I have a young man here in the studio. If you look at the entire cadre of people that are running for this seat, there is not one more uniquely qualified than this young man right here. Many of you know him. He has been in elected office before. But what you may not know is that he was born for public service. That's right. He came out serving the public. He's been with the top three most popular African-American Black Caucus members since he started working, really, from that young age. I bring to you none other than the next clerk of the Circuit Court of Cook County, Mr. Richard Boykin.
All right, Richard Boykin, what an introduction.
Well, thank you very much, Doris. I got to take you everywhere I go.
That's unbelievable. I thought it was Jesse Lewis Jackson there for a second. All right, Mr. Boykin, we're old friends, Richard Boykin and myself, back in that show, which
That's
I alluded
right.
to. He would come
right.
on. And in those days, you were a commissioner in the Cook County Board.
Correct.
I was alluding to the very contentious race you had with another good friend of mine, Brandon Johnson. I got friends on both sides. And he defeated you in that race. But let's talk a little bit about it. We're going to get into why you're running for clerk of circuit court, what the clerk of circuit court is, why it's an important position, and what you think you can do for it. But before we do that, let's just catch people up a little bit. When the last time you were on my show and you came into the hideout as well, you were very much a, how do I put this, like an independent. I would position you as an independent on the Cook County Board of Commissioners. You were unafraid to speak out against President Tony Preckwinkle, and particularly the issue that people know you, I think most know you for, is that you led the opposition to the what I call the soda pop tax, which is an ancient issue, Richard Boykin, but it was a very powerful and passionate one back in 2017, I want to say, or 2018.
That's right.
So talk about your time on the county board and sort of the legacy you have there.
Well, Ben, first of all, let me thank you for having me back on the show. And my, you got a great studio here. I'm honored to be here. Let me thank Doris Davenport as well. I'm Richard Boykin, and, you know, I was born in Mississippi, raised in Englewood. I'm a proud graduate of Chicago Vocational High School. I was elected to the county board in 2014 in a five-way race. I was the underdog, but we won the race. And we got on the county board, and we did a lot of innovational and transformational things. I was most proud of the fact that we did lead the effort to get rid of the sweetened beverage tax. I mean, it was more than just soda pop. It was juices and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm also proud of the fact that we got rid of the feminine hygiene tax that was on, you know, women whenever they go buy their materials. We got rid of that.
Tampons and menstruation pads.
Yes. Thank you, Doris.
I'm proud of the fact that we worked with the Inspector General and created a position at the county to deal with sexual harassment lawsuits, a dedicated position that's funded in the budget. We got that done. I passed legislation to prevent county police, county sheriff's police, forest preserve police from choking people when they apprehend them. We did a lot of stuff. We stood up with Dr. Willie Wilson and paid seniors property taxes so they wouldn't lose their homes mm-hmm. to the property tax sale. And so I'm so proud of these things that we've been able to accomplish on the county board. look, this is an opportunity running for clerk of the circuit court to provide vision and leadership over the busiest court system in the world, the second largest in the United States of America. And quite frankly, we have more lawsuits filed at the clerk of the circuit court than any other court in the world. And so Clerk Dorothy Brown's been there for 19 and a half years. It's what I call the front door to our justice system. So if you file a lawsuit or if you're a party to a lawsuit, you got to go through the clerk's office. I want to make sure that that front door is welcoming. I want to make sure that we have friendly staff, that we have staff that's informed and engaged, that take care of the customers who come through those doors. And I'm not just talking about taking care of lawyers, because that's one set, and I'm a lawyer, and I'm proud of that. But I'm also talking about taking care of those individuals who are pro se litigants, and we're seeing more and more pro se litigants come in, and that's people who are representing themselves that as lawyers. They don't have a lawyer. And so we got to make sure that that they get taken care of and that their issues get taken care of so that they can have access to justice. And so I'm so excited about that office and actually moving it forward, not only on the customer service side of things, but also on the technology side of things, bringing it into the 21st century, building upon the work that Clerk Dorothy Brown has done on expungement. Obviously, with the recreational marijuana law, there's going to be more than 500,000 people in the state eligible to have their records expunged. The clerk's office has been leading the effort in terms of expungement. I want to build upon that so that people will have an opportunity to have jobs, support themselves, support their families, and become taxpaying citizens. We want to make sure that we're accountable and transparent. I want to get us from under the Shackman decree. So that means no political hiring. That means we're going to do things above board. We're going to make sure that we report back to the taxpayers of Cook County. We do quarterly reports and that we're accountable. I want to make sure that people who utilize the office have an opportunity to say, hey, did that person provide good service for you? And if they didn't, then we have a problem, right?
All right, now let me break down some of the things you said. Before we go back to your days in the county commission, you've raised the issue of the court, so let's deal with that right now. And Richard, it's been a while, but I used to use the courthouse all the time looking for documents, looking up cases.
Right.
And so here's my evaluation of the clerk of the circuit court right now. The staff, they're very friendly. They're very outgoing. I give them an A. Okay. When I go there... or when I have in the past, they laugh at my jokes, okay, you know, which is get you far in life, and they provide the files very quickly and very courteously. So that's my opinion, the staff, and my humble opinion that Dorothy Brown hired and oversaw for all these years does a great job. But the court is like in the beyond that. It's like going back into time. It's almost like another century. I expect somebody with a fountain pen. I mean, a quill, as opposed to a fountain pen or a computer. And so it's this odd juxtaposition, Richard, where great staff, but like 1960s types of technology. And it's inexcusable to some degrees. Like lawsuits that you want to look up, you can't find on the internet. You can't get access to these public documents. And lawyers are always complaining to me who need it on a regular basis about how long the delays are, how inadequate it is. Do you think those my criticism is warranted when I talk about the court from this technological aspect?
Well, look, I think that obviously we can do better. I think that I've heard the same arguments. I've heard the same complaints from people, from lawyers, and from individuals whose files have been lost and they've had to stay in jail for an extra day or two because they couldn't find their file, which I think we have to tighten up things. I know there's a new case management system that just was launched a couple of weeks ago, a 30-some million dollar case management system. But I think that we have to bring to bear every ounce of technology that we have to innovate, to make things streamlined and simpler for everybody to access them, and to make sure that those files are readily accessible and that we don't lose them. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we digitize, and I know that Clerk Brown is in the process of digitizing documents, but I want to make sure that we go paperless. You know, at the end of my term, by the end of 4 years, I want to make sure that that office is paperless. And I also want to make sure that those individuals in the community who are suffering from the digital divide, who can't access computers or who have difficulty accessing computers, that they too can e-file, that they too have a process where they don't lose their justice rights because they're afraid of technology. Mm-hmm. So I embrace all of that. I embrace ideas from staff. I embrace ideas from outside lawyers, from constituents of the office itself. But one thing we got to do, Ben, and I'm serious about this, this office is not an office that's just for Democrats. This office doesn't belong to one political party. This office belongs to the taxpayers of Cook County, which is everybody. And so I will be the clerk that represents everybody, mm-hmm. and I'll make sure that that office works on day one.
All right. Now, when I'm listening to you talk, I'm going back in my mind to a roughly 2010 it was, and when Miguel de Valle took over as city clerk, and the filing system was such a joke for the city of Chicago in the first part of this century. And I could say this, Richard, as a guy who was constantly looking for a record, voting records. How did Alderman vote on a certain issue? What was a certain TIF ordinance? Mm-hmm. What was, you know, I wanted to see the actual documents. And it wasn't on the internet. It wasn't a computer. It was like the computer hadn't been invented yet. You had to go down to the public library, and they had the city council record books. I'm telling you, like these thick, like phone books of city council proceedings. And I give Delvaya credit for he was the one who brought in the computer geeks, and they got stuff online. And now pretty much I could follow anything in real time that the city council does. And I take advantage of that all the time. What is it about you, Richard Boykin, like the inner computer geek in you, that you could tell voters out there in Cook County that you know what to do to bring the courthouse into the 21st century?
So look, I've been prepared for this moment. Born in Inglewood, I understand what it's like to be in a situation where you're struggling. I have my share of struggles. We were on welfare, food stamps, in fact. And so most of the folks who come through that office are African Americans, Latinos. They're coming through. They're paying tickets. They're seeking child support. They're probating estates. And they're doing all sorts of things. And so we need somebody in that position who's compassionate, somebody who understands them. That office, we need to deal with the fees and the fines on these tickets. We need to make sure that we got somebody who can go to Springfield and say, hey, wait a minute. If people are in a certain income bracket, they shouldn't be worried about a spiral of debt because of a traffic ticket. You know, and so we need somebody who's compassionate, somebody who's thoughtful. Look, when I was on the county board, I brought together the best team. I had people around me who understood how to get things done. I also went directly to the people. I held more town hall meetings than anybody, and I solicited the ideas of the people, what they wanted to see. So I plan to leverage my legal training and work with the bar associations, work with the legal aid clinics and foundations to see how we all can work together to utilize their support. I want to extend the legal aid clinics into the clerk's office so that they can help those litigants who are pro se mm-hmm. litigants and litigants who are coming in, you know, just with basic questions of law mm-hmm. that, you know, if you're a clerk and you're not a lawyer, you can't be providing legal advice. But if you're with a legal clinic, and of course there's one there now working, but that line is so long downstairs in the Daly Center, I want to make sure that we have more people there providing services for the people of Cook County. I want to make sure that we use the best practices from around the country. There are a number of court systems that are running fine. Look, if you go into the federal court system, it's running smoothly. But certainly they don't have the volume of cases that we have in the clerk's office in the Circuit Court of Cook County. And so, you know, but we got to figure out how to get it done. And I'm the person who'll figure it out because I understand how to get these big things done.
Are you not afraid of technology? If the thought of me, for instance, running the courthouse would be so funny because I'm not that good. Richard, you probably know this. I can barely figure out a cell phone. You feel confident and capable of dealing with the various vendors who would be coming before you trying to sell the county on all new kind of technological innovations or updates, improvements. You feel capable of being able to pick apart the different proposals and understand from a technological standpoint what would be in the best interest of the taxpayers?
No question about it. I'm the most competent, qualified candidate for this position. And let me tell you, I bring the right people and put the right people on the team who will ask the tough questions. And I'll ask tough questions myself too. But I think when you have a team of individuals who are trained in certain areas, I'm not an expert in every area, but I'm smart enough to know that you got to have the right people on your team. I'm also smart enough to know that you got to do the things that are in the best interest of the county taxpayers. And that's what I've done my entire life, especially in public service to the county, but also when I worked for three of the most progressive members of Congress, Senator Carol Mosley Braun, Congressman Bobby Rush, and Congressman Danny Davis. I mean, I put people first. Mm-hmm. And when you put people first, I think everything else falls in place.
All right. We're going to switch gears here a little bit. I'm going to talk about a little political considerations. You talked about what you could do in terms of running the office. First, you got to get elected to the office. That, of course, I presume you've already put you brought your signatures in. You've collected your signatures and brought them in. Has anybody challenged your signatures?
Ben, the good news is we're on the ballot.
Okay, you're already on the ballot.
And guess what?
What?
Nobody challenged my signatures. And guess what, Ben? I submitted more signatures than anybody else, including the Democratic Party.
Wow. Nobody's challenged your signatures that I just leaped to the conclusion that my dear friend Ricky Hendon is supporting you because he would be the guy that challenges your signatures if anybody would. You know, I love you, Ricky Hendon. All right, now. Okay, so you're on the ballot. You haven't been challenged by the party. When you were on the board, as I pointed out, you were unafraid, to put it mildly, to challenge President Tony Preckwinkle. And as I pointed out, one of the great debates we ever had at the Hideout was with you and Larry Sufferton, who is Tony's finance committee chair and a very gifted debater, I might add, went at it over the issue of what you call the sweetened beverage tax, and I called it the soda pop tax. It was a great debate. I wish there were twice as many people to see it because they would always go to our seat. We weren't there that night. They would go, "My dear friend," and then they'd be like, "You mother beep." But they would always start with, "My dear friend," and then they would trash. Well, as my dear friend says, you know, Boykin's acting so nice now. He wasn't so nice that night at the Hideout. All right, so it was a very contentious dispute that you had, or difference of opinion, let's put it that way. So how are things right now with you and President Preckwinkle?
Look, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt said something great. She said, "Yesterday is history, tomorrow's a mystery, and today is a gift." And it's a present, basically. And then my friends from the Congressional Black Caucus said it like this. They said, "No permanent enemies, no permanent friends, just permanent interests." My interest is the taxpayers of Cook County. I will work with anybody. You know, it doesn't matter to me. I want to work with anybody, and I'll always put people first. Mm-hmm. I put my district first on that. I mean, let me tell you, in hindsight, had I voted for the pop tax, I get reelected overwhelmingly because I may draw a couple of opponents, but guess what? Labor unions don't put $1 million against me. I mean, and Tony Preckwinkle doesn't come after me. But I did what was in the best interest of the people. And I did, and I do the same thing today. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so, I mean, that's the kind of guy I am. I'm going to stand up for the people, and I'm going to do what I believe is right.
We were talking before you came on the show about Hillary's fight with Bernie and Bernie's fight with Hillary, and whether Hillary waited enough, or Bernie waited enough time, or it took too much time before he endorsed Hillary, and whether Hillary took too much time before she endorsed President Obama when he was running in 2008. Have you made up with Brandon Johnson? Have you? That was a very heated campaign. Are you getting along with him these days?
Let me tell you, Ben, one thing that you can know about me is I'm a bridge builder. I've reached out to Commissioner Johnson, and I've offered my assistance. I've offered, assistance on certain items. I believe that there's a piece of legislation that I introduced that would have provided free homes for police officers, firefighters, teachers, paramedics, first responders. If they live and work in endangered communities for 5 years, we give them a free home at the end of 5 years. That's a way to build up the community. I think he's going to look at that legislation, look at doing something around that. His relationship with President Preckwinkle, perhaps she'll do it. I mean, she wouldn't do it when I was there because I put the idea forward. But it's okay. I mean, because every idea whose time has come will eventually get to the forefront. And so it's all about being a bridge builder. And so, yes, the answer is I have reached out, and I've talked to him on numerous occasions. I'm looking forward, my friend, and I think that, what's ahead of me is much better than what's behind me. And so the good book says it like this, Ben: forgetting those things which are behind us, I'm pressing forward towards the mark of the high calling, which is in Christ Jesus. And that's what I'm doing.
Wow, it's pretty impressive that you can just quote some biblical. I'm not familiar with that particular quote, so I can't challenge you, Richard Boykin. I'm just gonna have to work that you got
good,
it right.
It sounds good. It's for real. It's in the good book.
Putting the good book aside, if you can get Brandon Johnson to endorse you and the Chicago Teachers Union to endorse you after what went down, then you deserve to be in the good book, because that will be a quite... I was talking about the need for Hillary to let it go and openly express gratitude to Bernie Sanders for what he did do, as opposed to worrying and concentrating about what he didn't do, okay? I was talking about that. And I believe in general, as a principle and a policy, that politicians should do. It's easy for me to say, Doris Davenport, because I've never run for office. But it is a contested game. It'd be like the Bulls still hating the Pistons for what went down in 1989 when they Lambeer hit Scottie Pippen in the head and knocked him out. So at some point, you got to get over it in politics, in my humble opinion, Richard. And so that's sort of my sermon for the day. Anything you want to say to folks before I let you go? Any like website where they can get more information about you? Any stuff like that, Richard Boykin?
Well, first of all, Ben, let me thank you, and let me thank Doris Davenport for having me on. I thank you for everything that you're doing in terms of providing great information for your listeners. If they want to learn more about the Boykin plan to reform the clerk's office, they can go on my website at www.richardrboykin.com. www.richardrboykin.com. We got a real plan. I'm excited about it. And if people want me to come to their community to talk about our plan, I'm delighted to do that as well. They can get me on Facebook at Richard R. Boykin, too, on Facebook.
I just want to add, typically, you all were talking so much about religion and quoting scripture and stuff. You typically see pastors passing the plate on Sundays. Mm-hmm. Last night, a wide range of pastors came together, not to pass the plate, but to fill the plate. They did a fundraiser for Richard R. Boykin. Can you believe that?
No.
The pastors
I don't believe
deep
that.
Into their
yes, they
own
did.
Pockets.
Yes, they did.
They did.
Some pastors I've never met. Anyway, but just, all right, Boykin, B-O-Y-K, I-N, correct?
Boykin.
Boykin, yeah. I have trouble with spelling. And you know what? In all fairness, I will bring all the candidates on. You know, Doris knows that. You got to be fair. Bring them all on. There's at least two, as I think of it now, off the top of my head, that are running, as well as Richard Boykin. So Jacob Meister's campaign has already been reaching out to me as well. So anyway, Richard Boykin. It was a blast talking to you again, and I hope, win or lose, you come back to the show.
Well, let me tell you, when we win, we're coming back.
Okay. All right. When we win, I like that confidence. Doris Davenport, thank you as well. Also want to thank Monroe Anderson, Adolfo Mondragon. What a great debate that was. Hillary and Bernie, man, it never gets old. The Democratic Party's got to figure some stuff out. And, of course, the man, the myth, the legend, as Richard Boykin knows, back home in Alton, Illinois, they call him White Lightning.
My name's Dennis.
Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Hey, and remember, you can download previous Ben Jarofsky shows and Benny J bonus interviews at both Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Reader websites and wherever else you download your favorite podcast. Downloaders, we live stream this program. It's true. Tuesdays through Fridays, 1 until 3 p.m. Central Time at both, at the Chicago Sun-Times YouTube channel, chicagosuntimes.com, chicagoreader.com. We hope you'll join us. See you tomorrow.